Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson. Let's be clear about something. We are living in the most unusual economic and financial circumstances of all time, is my opinion. Perhaps we've even become accustomed to them. Our baselines have shifted, and we've begun maybe to believe that it's normal for central banks to intervene in all markets at all times. Maybe we even believe they have everything under control to help us keep our bearings and provide essential perspective necessary to keep a level head during tilted times. Today, we are speaking with Jim Rickards, seasoned financier, risk manager, and author of the recent bestseller Currency Wars, as well as the upcoming book, The Death of Money, The Coming Collapse of the International Monetary System, scheduled to be published early 2014. Now, Jim is best known for his expertise in describing how currency wars are one of the most destructive and feared outcomes in international economics, and that history shows that they always end badly. He warns that today we are engaged in a new currency war, posing risks that every prudent individual, and maybe nation, should be aware of. Recent central bank actions from the U.S. to Japan have shown that the race to debase has entered high gear. Now, I've invited Jim here to help us understand what's most likely to come next and provide that essential context. Jim, hey, welcome. It's a real pleasure to have you back.
Thank you, Chris.
Now, earlier this month, you went on record predicting the Fed would not taper. Well, congratulations. You just earned some major prognosticating cred. Well, what was your rationale behind that call?
You know, Chris, it was actually very straightforward. I mean, going back to May when Chairman Bernanke first raised the issue of tapering, of course, there was speculation about it all summer. But if you listen to what Bernanke said, and they said this many times, other governors, Federal Reserve Bank presidents said, if the economy performs in accordance with our forecast, we are going to taper, in other words, reduce asset purchases. They actually phrased it the other way around. They said, we're going to reduce asset purchases if the economy performs in accordance with our forecast. Well, the markets focused on the first part, that they were going to reduce asset purchases, but ignored the conditionality, ignored the second part, which is if the economy performs. They always said it was data dependent. And they put out a forecast. Now, a couple things. The Fed has the worst forecasting record in economics. If you go back, every year they produce an economic forecast that's 1 year forward. So in 2009, they projected 2010. In 2010, they projected 2011, and so on. If you go back and look at those forecasts for the last 4 years, they were all wrong. They were not only wrong, but they were wrong by orders of magnitude, meaning the Fed was predicting, you know, 3% growth when it came in at 1.5%, or they were predicting 3.5% growth when it came in at 2%. They were always wrong. So the first thing about a Fed forecast is you should assume it's wrong, and it always is. And then if you looked at the actual data, it was coming in lousy. You know, the August employment report was way below expectations. Consumer confidence collapsed. Mortgage applications collapsed, you know, et cetera. And so all I did was take the Fed at the word. They said, if the data is bad, we're not going to taper. And the data was bad. So I said, they're not going to taper. And I said it repeatedly. I said it in interviews, you know, on Twitter, in speeches, you know, et cetera. I didn't think it was that difficult. I didn't think I was going out on a limb. Now, everyone else was, you know, almost everyone else was surprised, and they all woke up Friday morning, or Thursday morning, rather, and they were doing these postmortems that, gee, how could we be wrong? The Fed fooled us. And my answer is, you weren't fooled by the Fed. You fooled yourself, because there was a lot of wishful thinking. There was a lot of sense that, oh, you know, I go back to the green shoots, you know, the economy's getting better, et cetera. So I just took the Fed at their word. They said if the data was bad, they were not going to taper. The data was bad. So to me, it was an easy call.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I'm reading a lot of other headlines that suggest the economy is getting stronger. We just heard about record auto sales, you know, back to pre-slump levels at any rate. The housing market, existing home sales are way up. Of course, that might be institutional buyers, at least emboldened, if not enriched in part by all that Fed money sloshing out there. Do you think if the data did come in worse, though, that we might see the opposite? The Fed would untaper, in fact, increase their asset purchases? Is that in the cards?
Well, one of the things I said about the tapering decision, I said that they were not going to taper, but, you know, it was a close call. I mean, you have to admit that the Board of Governors was divided, and President Bullard of the St. Louis Fed said today, you know, it was a very close mm-hmm. call. So, I think that's fair. But I also said if they did taper, I didn't think they would, but if they did taper, I projected they would reverse course and increase asset purchases by the middle of next year. And that's still on the table. And if, by the way, the Fed has said that. This is not guesswork. The Fed has said, see, this is the difference between, Chris, this is the difference between QE3 and QE2. The mistake that the Fed made in QE2, they put a specific dollar amount and a specific time limit on it. They announced it in September of 2010. They launched it in November 2010. And they said by June 2011, we are going to purchase $600 billion worth of intermediate term Treasury securities. Well, the problem was, the minute you announce an amount and a date, which they did, the market immediately discounts it. And the stock market rallied in September and October 2010 based on the announcement effect alone. The problem was, the market says, well, fine, it's over in June. What else have you got? In other words, by putting a time limit and a dollar amount limit on it, they got the pop up front, but then the market immediately said, what comes next? And they didn't have it next, you know, so they did Operation Twist. Now, when they got to QE3, they learned from their mistake. QE3 has no end date and no amount. They're buying an amount per month. They said $85 billion per month. We know that. But they didn't say whether they could increase it, decrease it, extend it. And the answer is they can. They've kept all those options on the table. So we actually don't know what they're going to do, and except to say they've said it's data dependent. So my advice is just watch the data. But sure, we could head into a recession in early 2014. And if we do, they might actually increase asset purchases. So you can't rule that out. But I just take it one month at a time. I'm going to take the Fed at their word. They said it depends on the data, so just look at the data and draw some logical conclusions.
Well, Jim, how extraordinary is this circumstance? I mean, let's just one step back. I look at this and I see that the Fed is now not even really providing guidance anymore, because their guidance is it depends, right? You know, if the data goes up or down, they're going to be in a reactive mode, which is hardly a good verbal guidance. And they're not providing any concrete guidance in any way, shape, or form. They did set a couple of targets. Maybe it was 6.5% unemployment. Maybe it was 2% inflation. But Bernanke's been providing some nebulous wiggle room around those as well. How extraordinary is this to be printing $85 billion a month with basically no guidance on how long it might continue?
Well, it's more than extraordinary, Chris. I mean, it's a very good question. It's actually unprecedented. There's never been anything like this. Now, you go back to the Great Depression, and scholars, including Ben Bernanke, have studied that very closely. And they said that the problem was, you know, we had a business cycle. We had a bubble. It burst in 1929. There was deflation. There was depression. And the Fed blundered. The Fed kept money too tight in 1927, 1928. That caused the Great Depression, and that they didn't loosen up fast enough. So they're like generals fighting the last war. They said, aha, we figured out the Great Depression. The Fed should have printed money. So now come all the way forward to, 2008, 2009. They said, we're not going to make that mistake twice. We're going to print lots and lots of money. But it never occurred to them that they were making a new mistake. In other words, who says that printing money was the answer in 1933? I mean, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. Actually, there were other things going on. There was what's called regime uncertainty, which is business people didn't know what the investment climate was going to be like, and they kind of went to the sidelines. And that's what I see happening now. The reason the economy is not moving is because, you know, on the consumer side, you've still got deleveraging going on, and then you can drive an economy with investment. But, I mean, if you were going to commit, say, let's say you were going to commit $5 billion of capital to a 10-year infrastructure project, that was your job inside of some major corporation, and you had to figure that out. Well, you know, what are your health care costs going to be? What are your taxes going to be? What is the environmental regulation going to be? You have no idea. And so businesses are just saying, look, I'll move to the sidelines, hang on to my cash. Maybe I'll invest in India or Malaysia or someplace. So I'm not going to invest in the United States because I don't know what the deal is. Well, that's continuing, you know, because of gridlock, because the Republicans and the Democrats don't want to work together, because the White House is sort of taking this, you know, my way or the highway approach. You just don't know. I mean, today we have an announcement from the EPA that they're using unprecedented regulatory powers to impose greenhouse gas emissions limitations on new power plants. Now, you don't have to get into that debate, or at least I don't. I mean, I don't want to argue whether that's a good idea or a bad idea. I'm just making the point that when you wake up in the morning and there's a massive new regulation and you don't know what's coming next, as a business person, you don't want to invest in that environment. So consumption is deleveraging. Investment is, flat to down because no one knows what the deal is. government spending's being cut because of the sequester. So none of the components of GDP are really contributing, with the possible exception net exports, which is where the currency wars come in. So, you know, we're like a four-cylinder car that's, you know, not firing on three cylinders, maybe all four. So it's not surprising we're in this kind of malaise. I would expect it to continue. I mean, these are, we have structural problems. The Fed is trying to address it with cyclical solutions, meaning liquidity solutions. But you can't solve a structural problem with a liquidity solution. You need a structural solution. I don't see any on the table, so I would expect we're just going to chug along with this, you know, kind of 1-1.5% growth as far as the eye can see.
Now, hang on here. We're talking about high government deficits, stubborn unemployment, low interest rates, ultra low interest rates, and low growth. This sounds a lot like Japan. I thought that Bernanke had a solution for us not to turn into Japan.
Well, it's actually exactly like Japan. It's ironic because you go back to 2000, even 2007, 2008. You know, public officials, Bernanke in particular, the Board of Governors in particular, said over and over, we are not going to repeat the mistakes of Japan. Well, guess what? We have repeated every single mistake of Japan. We are Japan. And that's why, you know, people say that forecasting is hard. I like to say forecasting is easy. What's hard is getting the model right. You know, if you get the model right, the forecasting is easy. But most people don't get the model right. The model right now is we look like Japan. I mean, for example, in 2008, what should have happened is the major banks should have been shut down. They should have been nationalized by the government, stockholders wiped out, management fired, some of them put in jail, bondholders should have taken a haircut, the government should have stripped out the bad assets, put them in some kind of trust for the American people, you know, sell them gradually over 20 years, and then take what's left, which would be a clean bank with new management and a new balance sheet, IPO it, because you don't want the government owning the banks forever, you just want it. Do this temporary solution, IPO it, and put some clean banks out there that can make some loans. Instead, what did we do? We preserved them. We preserved the bad assets. We preserved the bad management. We propped them up. We gave them subsidies in the form of zero interest rate policy, et cetera. We did exactly what Japan did, which is we didn't confront the problem. There was cronyism, elitism, the government taking care of their buddies in the private sector, et cetera. So we didn't clean up the mess, and so we should not expect a different result. We should expect the same result, which is, you know, a decade or more of low growth. I mean, look at every year since 2008. You know, in 2009, people talked about green shoots. In 2010, Secretary Geithner talked about the recovery summer. In 2011, economists were projecting, you know, stronger growth in the second half. Same thing in 2012. They were wrong every single time. Well, the reason they're wrong is because they're using the wrong model. They're assuming this is a normal cyclical recovery where, you know, you go down and then you cut rates and then you go back up again. That's not what we have. We're in a depression and we're going to stay in a depression until there are structural changes, but I don't see any on the horizon. So I would just say, you know, we're in a depression as far as the eye can see. By the way, you know, people keep saying, you know, when is this recovery going to take off and get a little more robust, and when is growth going to go up to 3.5%? We could actually have a recession in 2014. I mean, I got news for people. This recovery is 4 years old. The average recovery is, you know, kind of about 55, 56 months. And this one's, you know, we're 48 months into it. So, we might very well have a recession next year.
Well, as we wait for our mythical third half recovery to come along, I'm noting that, we have equities at all-time highs, not just in the U.S., but across the globe. The German DAX is at all-time highs. We've got bonds priced to perfection. Both of those seem inconsistent with the idea that we might be long in the tooth in this particular recovery, or that there might be a recession on the horizon. To me, it feels bubblicious. I mean, I'm looking at price earnings ratios on some of the headline equities out there that are back to 1999 levels. It feels priced to perfection, but as you mentioned, that the data is anything but perfect at this moment in time. Where do you see this going?
Well, I think stocks will continue to go up. I agree it's a bubble, but the thing you have to remember about bubbles is they can go on for a long time. I mean, just because you can step back and see it's a bubble doesn't mean it won't get, you know, more bubbly, so to speak. So I think stocks will continue to rally on Fed money printing. It will crash at some point, but it doesn't mean tomorrow. It doesn't mean next month. So I think stocks will do well through the end of the year, particularly because of the no tapering decision. I wouldn't invest in them, but a lot of people are, and I think they'll go higher before they crash. The bond market is a different story because everyone says the bond market is, you know, priced to perfection. It's got nowhere to go but down. But people don't really pay attention to the difference between nominal rates and real rates. I agree that nominal rates are, you know, close to all-time lows, but real rates are actually still high. You go back to 1980, for example, we had 13% bond rates, but inflation was 15%, meaning the real rate was negative 200 basis points. That's cheap. In other words, that's really monetary easy. You say, gee, how can you have that with 13% interest rate? So the answer is inflation was 15%. Now today, the 10-year note's kind of around, you know, 2.7, thereabouts, but inflation is only 1. So we have positive real rates of 175 basis points, which is very steep. So I think rates are very high. Nominal rates are low, but real rates are high, and that's where the action is. I mean, I could see the 10-year note going all the way down to 80 basis points, which is where it is in Japan. That would be one of the greatest bond market rallies in history. So this is what Bill Gross and others are seeing, which is they're seeing deflation. They're seeing the Fed's efforts to create negative real rates, and bond rates could actually come down in nominal space because they're really quite high in real space.
Well, that leaves the equity market sort of hanging out over a cliff at this point in time. So I want to turn my attention now, our attention to what all of this impact might be on the emerging markets. We've certainly seen the Fed, the ECB, Bank of Japan, this liquidity has come out. It's sloshing around. We have the usual dynamic, hot money needs somewhere to go. The carry trade is just alive and well. And this can be extraordinarily disruptive for the thinner, more peripheral markets. I understand you've had a recent experience of going to the periphery and having some interesting talks there. I'd wonder if you could give us your take on the dynamic of all this money printing on the rest of the world.
Sure. I spent a couple of weeks in South Africa a few weeks ago, and I'm actually heading out to Eastern Europe. I'll be in Warsaw, Vienna, and Bratislava next week. So I'm spending quite a bit of time in emerging markets. And they're just they just feel like they're thoroughly abused at this point. I mean, the Fed is trying to wash its hands of emerging markets. The Fed has said, and when I say the Fed, I mean, you know, Bernanke himself and other, you know, Federal Reserve Bank presidents and members of the Board of Governors have said, look, our job is to run the U.S. economy. And you emerging markets, you're kind of on your own. You know, you got your own central banks. You know, you figure out monetary policy. Well, it's not that easy. I mean, the dollar is the leading reserve currency. Most of these countries maintain a large portion of their reserves in dollars. They rely on, you know, dollar capital markets are the largest in the world. These dollar hot money inflows, you know, race in, race out. You know, in South Africa, you know, the currency went from, you know, 8 to the dollar, almost to 11 to the dollar in a matter of months, and now it's back, heading back down again. And that was the rand is getting stronger, because of the tapering decision. So, it's highly disruptive. You're almost begging these countries to put on capital controls. I mean, what are they supposed to do? Raise interest rates to defend their currencies when unemployment's high? That, you know, that doesn't really make sense, but they sort of have no choice because of what the Fed's doing. So I think the Fed is risking creating a crisis in emerging markets, sort of a replay of what happened in 1997 with Thailand. I don't think they understand it. I don't think they understand the interconnectedness and the vulnerability and the critical state nature of the global monetary system. And they're sort of, you know, they think they're dialing a thermostat up and down, but they're actually playing with a nuclear reactor, and they could melt the whole thing down. So it's an extremely dangerous state of affairs. But I do have a lot of sympathy with the emerging markets. They're trying to do the right thing, but we don't have a gold standard. We don't have a dollar standard. We don't have fixed exchange rates. We've got floating exchange rates that are being manipulated by the Fed. So I don't think you can blame the emerging markets for feeling they're just kind of victims at this point because, you know, it's risk on, risk off, money in, money out every other day, it seems. And you're right. When it looked like the Fed was going to taper, interest rates were going higher. People were unwinding the carry trade. You know, they borrowed dollars, so you're effectively short the dollar. They convert to these emerging market currencies. They plunge into these stock and bond markets in places like India and South Africa, Indonesia, you know, Thailand and elsewhere. They make a nice spread. They leverage the trade and make a lot of money. Well, the minute you think interest rates are going to go up, you want to unwind the trade. So they dump the emerging markets assets, dump the emerging markets currencies, pay back their dollar loans, unwind the carry trade, and then these places are, you know, in shock, and then all of a sudden the Fed doesn't taper. It's like, oh, put the trade back on again. Here we come, you know. So I just think that it's hard to blame the emerging markets when they're really just on the receiving end of the of Fed dollar and currency and interest rate manipulation. They do think the Fed is risking some kind of a global meltdown because they don't understand that dynamic.
Well, the Fed is, I believe, if, you know, I'm not even paraphrasing much, but they've basically said emerging markets are on their own, just washing their hands saying, oh, you know, you guys have your policies, we have ours. But it's not that simple, is it?
Not at all. I mean, that ignores the extent to which the dollar is not just our currency, it's a global reserve currency, the extent to which, and by the way, these capital markets are not that big. I mean, you look at the size of them, relative to capital flows from dollars, I mean, they're tiny. Even a big country like Australia, an important country, but those capital markets are small relative to what we are accustomed to in the U.S. And even in Europe. And so when investors decide they want in, this is like a flood of money. And I do think some of these countries may have to get a little more creative. I said to, I've been in Korea and Australia recently and met with government officials in both countries. And I said, well, what you want to do, if you want to cheapen your currency, the best way to do that is print money and buy gold. That way you can target an exchange rate and keep the gold. So instead of, buying more dollar denominated bonds. So, no one's doing that, of course, but there are kind of more creative ways, or just issue bonds in your local currency. You know, if the capital markets want your paper, well, give it to them. But then put the money to good use. Don't waste it, of course, but build infrastructure projects to do things that are going to add to economic productivity and prosperity in your country. So there are some creative solutions, but they're not being used. What the central banks are doing is they're either just kind of sucking it up and learning to live with a strong currency, which is good. I mean, that's what Germany and Singapore have done successfully, and I think we're seeing that in Korea. Or in the case of Australia, they're joining the currency wars, cutting rates, trying to cheapen their currency, even as we're trying to cheapen the dollar. All that does is get you inflation. Actually, Brazil is a very interesting case because in 2011, 2012, Brazil fought the currency wars by cutting rates, trying to cheapen their currency at a time when the U.S. was trying to cheapen the dollar. And I said at the time, that's not going to work. All you're going to do is get inflation. And that's exactly what happened. Brazil got the inflation. Now Brazil is having to raise rates to try to tamp down the inflation. And the same thing's going to happen in Australia. So some countries are doing it right. I would say Singapore, Korea, and Canada are good examples. Some countries are doing it wrong. I would say Australia, Brazil's kind of changed course recently, but they got it wrong for a couple of years. And other countries are just baffled. Thailand, South Africa, some of these other emerging markets. They're just looking for stability and they're not finding it.
Well, isn't that sort of par for the course? Is in a game of international currency wars, everybody can't win. And so it sounds like you're describing countries that are all trying to find relative advantage in a game that's ultimately zero sum. So the big kid on the block probably has some additional advantages. We've got Japan in the process of doubling its monetary base in 2 years. We've got the U.S. Fed recommitted to providing liquidity far out into the horizon. Well, unless the laws of economics have been rewritten, these actions, they have to come to an end sooner or later. So my question is, how does this all end? Will it be self-selected, or do you think it might be forced upon everybody by some market event?
Well, it'll end in a collapse of the international monetary system. And when I say that, that's not really meant to be a provocative statement. The international monetary system has collapsed three times in the past 100 years. It collapsed in 1914. It collapsed again in 1939. And it collapsed in 1971. So these things do happen. They haven't happened recently, but they do have a tendency to happen. And when it happens, it's not the end of the world. It doesn't mean we all go, live in caves and eat canned goods. What it means is that you have to reboot the system. That means the major economic powers have to get together and, sit down at the table and rewrite the rules of the game. So I spent a lot of time thinking about what the future international monetary system will look like, what it will look like after this collapse. So I think that's the most likely outcome. One of the things I've said about currency wars, is that we're not always in a currency war, but when we are, they can last for a very long time. They can last for, 10 or 15 years. That's what happened in the 1930s, and that's what happened in the 1970s, as I describe in my book. And so, this currency war just started in 2010. Here we are in 2013. A lot of people have said about my book, gee, how did you know we would, this currency war would be going on in 2013? And I said, well, first of all, it started in 2010. I think we're going to be talking about it in 2014 and 2015. Currency wars don't have a logical ending because it's just back and forth and back and forth. And it's actually worse than a zero-sum game. It's a negative-sum game because you actually destroy wealth and create suboptimal outcomes and inefficiencies by the currency war itself. So it's a disastrous state of affairs. I don't expect it to be over anytime soon because, as they say, countries just keep fighting back and forth. What I do expect to come out of it is inflation first and then finally a collapse.
And this collapse, what will this look like in your mind? Are we going to see this playing out in the bond market, in the actual currency markets?
It'll play out in all markets. It's really, when I say collapse, it's a loss of confidence in paper money. In other words, take the Fed, for example. The Fed has printed almost $3 trillion since 2007. Now, that's without a liquidity crisis. I mean, we did have a liquidity crisis in 2008, and the first round, I was at QE1, was a legitimate central bank response to liquidity crisis. But QE2 and QE3, we'll look back on them and they'll just be we'll see them as enormous blunders and one of the greatest failed experiments in economic history. But the problem is the Fed printed trillions of dollars without a liquidity crisis. What's going to happen when we do have a liquidity crisis, which I expect in the next couple of years, when there's a kind of a 2008 panic starting again? What are they going to do? Print $6 trillion, $9 trillion? I mean, there's a limit on what they can do. And so at some point, it's going to get handed over to the IMF, and they're going to have to print SDRs, you know, the special drawing rights. That's the IMF's world money. Because none of the central banks have clean balance sheets at this point. They look like bad hedge funds. And so it really is a loss of confidence. Confidence is the key word. A loss of confidence in paper money. And that confidence is going to have to be restored somehow. And there are really only two ways. One is the SDR, which no one understands. So maybe they can kind of reliquify the world by printing SDRs and create massive inflation, but no one will really understand where it's coming from. And the other way is gold, which would restore confidence. But to have a non-deflationary price of gold, you're looking at $7,000 an ounce, you know, very possibly higher, maybe as high as $9,000 or $10,000 an ounce. I know that sounds extreme, but it's really just eighth grade math. If you look at the money supplies and look at the physical amount of gold, you know, people say you can't have a gold standard because there's not enough gold. Well, that's not true. I mean, there's always enough gold. It's just a question of price. So the theoretical question is, what is a non-deflationary price for gold if you had to go back to a gold standard? And the answer is, you know, it's north of $7,000 an ounce. So that's the kind of thing that you might see. It's not what any central bank wants. It's not what the elites want. But it's the kind of thing you could get if you had to restore confidence. So, you know, that's what the future of the international monetary system will look like. But right now we're still, the Fed's still behind the wheel and they're still driving the bus over the cliff.
Well, as we look across the currency landscape, we note that, Kissinger did something quite smart in arranging the petrodollar, meaning that all oil was traded in dollars effectively, and that held for a long time. And we're seeing early signs that that's unwinding with China and Russia both starting to navigate towards trading in different currencies, pieces like that. So as I've been noticing, to connect these dots, that a lot of gold has been flowing from west to east. China's been buying a lot. Russia's recently announced, at least officially, that they've got a pretty decent hoard now at the central level. Do you think that this flow of gold from west to east, is that intentional at this point in time on the part of the players in the east? Are people connecting dots in the way you are and looking forward and saying, we don't know when, but eventually this all might be reset around gold, so he who has the gold will be a relative winner in this game? Do you think that is being played out at some official level?
Of course. I mean, this is what we said. If you go back to the first two chapters in Currency Wars, that book came out in 2011, but we described a war game that was conducted by the Pentagon at a top secret weapons laboratory outside of Washington. And I was one of the designers of that game and one of the participants and helped to recruit other people who played in that game. And this was in 2009, so it was 4 years ago. And what we said at the time was that Russia and China would acquire gold and move towards a gold-backed currency, not the ruble or the yuan. No, there's no way the Russian ruble or the Chinese yuan are anywhere close to being reserve currency. That's not on the table. But you could have a new currency backed by gold, or you could have an SDR backed by gold, in which the people with the most gold would have the largest clout, if you will, in the new international monetary system. Well, we were pretty much laughed at and ridiculed at the time, but since then, Russia has increased its gold reserves by two-thirds. They've gone from about 600 tons to over 1,000 tons. China has increased its gold reserves by a multiple, from 1,000 tons to some number. No one knows the exact number, but best estimates and best research I've been able to apply to it says, you know, somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 tons. So, in other words, things have played out exactly as we predicted in 2009. It's all in the book. It was kind of put in front of the Pentagon from a national security perspective. I like to remind people that you can't have a strong national security without a strong currency. And if the Treasury and the Fed and the White House are undermining the dollar, they're also undermining U.S. national security. So that's exactly what's going on, you know, but it's a long game. I mean, the problem with markets today is I find everyone has like a 2-second attention span.
Mm-hmm.
You know, gold goes down 4% one day and everyone's like, oh, it's the end of gold or whatever. And no, gold is volatile. It will remain volatile, but the long-term trend is much higher because of these forces that we just described.
Well, so what options then do nations or individuals have really for surviving these currency wars? I mean, what advice would you give to somebody who lives in Japan, which is actively debasing its currency, or to the U.S.? What do individuals do here?
Well, the individual should own gold. Now, I recommend 10% gold for the conservative investor, 20% gold for the aggressive investor. Not more than that. I mean, you have some people that are 50% in gold or 100% in gold. I don't think that's really smart or necessary. If you have 10 to 20% and, you know, gold goes down a little bit, you're not going to get hurt too badly. And if it goes up as I expect, that's really going to ensure and insulate the rest of your portfolio. So, I think, you know, you don't have to be helpless. You don't have to be a victim. I think, you know, if you have $1 million, you should have $100,000 in gold. If you have $100,000, you should have $10,000 in gold. If you have $10,000, go buy one American Gold Eagle, which is, you know, a little more than 10%. But the point is, have some gold, and then, you know, whatever happens in all these other markets, you'll have the insurance you need to protect yourself.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Jim. I'm interested in helping people find more of your work so they can follow you, and also if you could tell us when they can look forward to your book coming out.
Sure. Thank you, Chris. Of course, Currency Wars is still selling very well, so that's available from Amazon. My new book, The Death of Money, the publication date is April 8th, 2014. So, it's finished, but we're going through the editing and the editing process right now. So that'll be out on the bookshelves on April 8th. And in the meantime, if people are interested, they can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at James G. Rickards, middle initial G, last name R-I-C-K-A-R-D-S. So just, you know, go to at James G. Rickards. And my Twitter feed is open, meaning you don't actually have to join Twitter. You can, of course, and you kind of join the conversation, but you can just find it online at James G. Rickards. And I put out a steady stream of commentary on capital markets and the international monetary system.
Well, as always, Jim, just brilliant stuff. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Chris.